You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and coming up, we go over yesterday's State of the Tribes address. But now, what's the biggest story across Wisconsin over these last couple of days? It has to be where the Green Bay Packers four-time MVP quarterback will be playing his 19th season, or whether he'll be playing football at all. Rumors are swirling around Aaron Rodgers, but as of last check, he has not been traded to another team, and he is still a Green Bay Packer. However, that didn't stop Rodgers from making clear his intentions earlier today on the Pat McAfee Show.
At this point, as I sit here, you know, I think since Friday, I made it clear that my intention was to play, and my intention was to play for the New York Jets.
Okay.
And I haven't been holding anything up at this point. It's been compensation that the Packers are trying to get.
Does he undermine that compensation by announcing his intentions outright this afternoon? Is there any chance Aaron Rodgers could be back in green and gold? And if not, what does that mean for the future of the Packers? And for longtime Packer fans, doesn't this offseason feel all too familiar? Pete Daugherty is the Packers columnist for USA Today Network Wisconsin. And Pete, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Lee. How are you today?
I am very curious about what Aaron Rodgers is doing and why he's announced his intentions to play for the New York Jets. Isn't this a decision to be made by the Packers, and doesn't he undermine his intent by announcing what he wants?
Well, he's got a lot of say in this whole thing because of his contract. He's going to be paid $59 million guaranteed this year. So all he has to do is show up. So if the Packers want to trade him, he needs to cooperate, because the team isn't going to trade for him unless he says he wants to play for him and is good with it. Nobody wants to trade for a quarterback who doesn't want to play for him. And he could always just up and retire and then unretire, you know, before the season starts. So that would just be a big mess. So no, he definitely has say in this. And, you know, we've all known for how long now? I'm not even sure how long this has been going. Over a week, I think, right? So the Jets went and visited him. Was that a week ago today? It might have been a week ago, or a week ago yesterday. It might have been. So we've known for at least a week here that this was going to happen.
And we also know that he had a wish list of players he'd like to play with, according to ESPN. And the Jets actually acquired one of those players on his list already.
Yeah, and it sounds like they're interested in at least one or maybe two of the others. He balked at that and said he didn't present him with a list. He said they asked him about players, what he thought of them. I'm sure he said something effect of, you know, it'd be great if you could bring these guys in. I doubt the whole deal swings on whether they, you know, sign these guys and bring in these guys that he played with the Packers. But, you know, they're doing everything they can to set up a situation that he wants to be in. That's pretty obvious.
Pete, you've been covering the Packers for 30 years now. Doesn't this sort of ring familiar to what happened to Hall of Fame quarterback Brett Favre in 2008? How would you compare and contrast that?
Yeah, it's just incredibly similar in so many ways. I mean, you know, they each had a replacement drafted in the first round. It took 3 years till it actually happened. You know, that guy sat behind Rodgers behind Favre for 3 years, Love behind Rodgers for 3 years. These things run their course. These quarterbacks get so big, they want more say in things. The teams, I think, wear down, you know, the maintenance that goes with it. With Favre, it was whether he would retire. With Rodgers, it was him being upset with the organization and then recouping some of his power by winning those two MVPs and getting a new contract. It's incredibly similar, and the Packers can only hope and pray that Jordan Love turns out to be something like the two guys before him. I mean, it's unheard of for the league to draft a Hall of Fame quarterback to replace one, and it would be off the charts unheard of to do that twice in a row, with first Rodgers and then if Love turned out to be anything like that kind of player.
So we're ready to write off Aaron Rodgers as a Packer in the coming NFL season. Is that right?
Yeah, I cannot imagine circumstances where he's back with the Packers now. That ain't happening.
So what does this mean for the green and gold this season? I mean, still they're in the NFC North, so you figure they've there's a been a recent lack of competition in their football division. But what does the Packers look like with a new quarterback at the helm this year?
Yeah, it's a whole new world they're entering here. I mean, they entered it briefly in 08, you know, not knowing how good Rodgers would be. But by 09, they even halfway through 08, they signed him to a contract extension. And by 09, they made the playoffs. But, you know, it was 22 years, I think, between Bart Starr and Brett Favre. And teams go longer than that. Chicago's been looking to replace Sid Luckman, and I think he retired in 51. So, you know, this is a brand new world. They're getting to, they'll spend at least a season or half a season learning how it's, what it's like to be, you know, amongst the other half of the NFL. It'll be really interesting to see how good this guy is, how, what kind of coach is Matt LaFleur when he doesn't have a Hall of Fame quarterback. How will the offense look different? It was, you know, LaFleur changed the offense to, you know, to appease Rodgers, to meet him halfway on some of the things Rodgers likes to do. Now we'll presumably see more pure version of LaFleur's offense with a young quarterback. It's it'll be really interesting times, and lots on the line, because if Love isn't good enough, and they know that by the end of the 23 season, then they're right back, you know, looking for a new quarterback next year at this time.
Pete Daugherty, our guest, Packers columnist for USA Today, Network Wisconsin. And Pete, we started the conversation with talking about Aaron Rodgers guaranteed, what was it, $59 million this year?
Yeah, basically, yep.
Does that free up any room for the Packers to move and make some big acquisitions before the season kicks off?
It does not, because, you know, to get into the, I don't want to get too deep into the nuances of the salary cap, but it actually, to keep him, he would have counted $31 million on the cap. To trade him, because of the way the cap rules work, where his salary this year comes off, but future prorated money all accelerates to this year, they actually... he'll cost $40 million on the cap with the trade. So that's $9 million more. So they'll actually have $9 million less cap room to work with. But the huge upside is they're not stacking all this $59 million onto future caps, which they would be if they kept him. So he's off their books next year. They're free and clear. He won't count anymore next year. So next year at this time, they'll have a lot more money to work with than they would have if they had kept him.
So I appreciate you speculating earlier, but if you look at the NFC North this season, what are the Packers' shot without Aaron Rodgers and making the playoffs this year?
You know, you would think pretty slim. I mean, they went, you know, look how good Aaron Rodgers turned out to be, and they went 6-10 in his first year as a starter. So even if Love turns out to be a really good quarterback, I would think this would still be a pretty rough year. And if he's not good enough, it could be a really rough year. You never know. They went 9-7 in Favre's first year as a starter, didn't make the playoffs, but they did go 9-7. So if I were betting just right now, I would, you know, guess around a 5 or 6 or 7 win season. But, you know, you just don't know how Love is going to play. So you just – the smart money says even if he looks pretty good and looks like he's a keeper, he's going to make – a young quarterback's mistakes, enough of them to lose them a bunch of games.
Well, if there's a feel good in all this, I'd have to imagine that it's what you said earlier. The Bears are still looking for their next Sid Luckman.
And yeah, I mean, even the Vikings have been looking for a quarterback for a long time. It's hard to, these guys are hard to find.
Yes.
They really are. You know, the Broncos since Elway, they haven't found one. You know, they tried Russell Wilson, so far, not so good. So, that's a merry-go-round you definitely don't want to be getting on in the NFL.
Hey, Pete, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lee.
Pete Daugherty is the Packers columnist for USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us today to look at the future of Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an ode to a car.
Some people get really passionate about taking sides on everyday things that make our lives a little sweeter. Coke versus Pepsi, the Beatles versus the Stones, Biggie versus Tupac, and of course, manual versus automatic transmission. Writer Nancy Jorgensen is team manual and tells us about her love of and nostalgia for driving stick shift.
A few months before our wedding, my boyfriend bought me a car I couldn't drive. A cherry red two-door Volkswagen Beetle, like a little sugar bun, round and sweet. I settled in the bucket seat, hesitant after my single parking lot lesson on manual transmissions. I checked the mirrors, jerked into traffic. Don't be afraid on the hill. I shifted, gave it gas. Sedans and station wagons zipped past. The engine putt-putt sputtered, quit. A rookie with four on the floor, I didn't realize the car was in third gear. I fumbled with the clutch and stick, and after several attempts, found first gear and slipped back on the road. As the four-cylinder, 60-horsepower engine purred in the rear, I relaxed a bit and let the wind tangle my hair. By the time I pulled into our alley garage, imaginary stars twinkled my Beetle, with its pedal for my left foot and its knob for my right hand. Already, I craved more practice with step ball change choreography. Soon, the clutch and I were like lovers. We went everywhere together. My parents' house to swim in the pool, my grandma's cottage to gather beans and eggs, my daughter's daycare center so I could teach choir classes at work. In summer, with the windows cranked, driving delivered whiffs of freshly cut grass. In winter, with a hole in the floorboard, commuting coughed up ice and sleet. That car wedded me to the road, so close were the steering wheel and windshield, so tight the space between me and Wisconsin's wavering weather. Eventually, I traded my 72 Bug for a family car with four doors. But every vehicle since, 87, 97, 09, required my left foot dance with a clutch. Five years ago, when a surgeon damaged my boyfriend, now husband's, left leg, we surrendered our manual transmission. The dealer almost refused our trade-in. "No one wants a stick shift anymore," he said. "Won't be able to sell it." Is it possible to pine for a pedal? To love a rubber-covered hunk of metal? To feel an absent clutch like a phantom limb? I sense its presence. I anticipate using it. My leg twitches and hovers in its void. But the clutch isn't all I've lost. I'll never again have parents with a backyard pool. No more grandma with gardens and chickens. No more baby daughters strapped in the back seat. Nostalgia is like a 1970s poncho. It covers me in discordant threads. Some delicate, light, and brief, some weighty, rough, and lasting. Strands of memory intertwine, and it's impossible to separate one from the others. Last week, a snappy little convertible with a lion's roar zoomed past me in the park, and I felt something like longing. I imagined myself in a leather seat, downshifting on a hill, gliding through gears third, fourth, fifth, cruising Lake Michigan's shore, sailboats on the horizon, leaning into curves at 50 miles an hour. In real life, I get behind the wheel of my SUV. A screen tells me where to go, an air conditioner cools to a precise number, and a cabin cradles me far above the bumpy pavement. But it's hard to navigate when the parts I love the most are no longer there.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer who lives in Waukesha. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we get a look at 2023's State of the Tribes address and what Indigenous leaders are advocating for in Wisconsin. That's next, here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. The 2023 State of the Tribes address was held yesterday at the state capitol. It covered the opioid epidemic, environmental issues, and more. The annual speech dates back to 2005, and it gives Wisconsin's tribes a chance to highlight issues that are important to Indigenous communities across the state. Here to share more about yesterday's address is Richard Ackley, a retired judge for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And Judge Ackley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on again.
Yeah, yesterday the address was given by Sacagawea Chippewa community leader, Chairman Robert Van Zyl Jr. What stood out to you about his address?
What I liked about Tribal Chairman Van Zyl's presentation is I must do a historic note. I believe at times the speeches of the tribes by the state to the state of the tribe address that's given to the Wisconsin State Legislature, that high schools and colleges should hear that, because one of the interesting dynamics is I don't believe enough people in the state have an in-depth understanding of Native issues or Native sovereignty. And then two, the tribes have a system where other tribal chairmen contribute to the speech. And it would be nice if, and I really appreciate the fact that the governor, the executive staff, the elected officials, attorney general, the Senate, and the assembly were present. But sometimes, even though they sit together, in the tribes, they look for collective views of expressing themselves. And I'm hoping in some ways that that reflection of their collective unity could be a reflection of the unity of the elected officials and the executives in the state of Wisconsin. And I'll be kind of quick because the limit.
Oh, and we just lost our guest. I apologize. Judge Richard Ackley joining us with a discussion about yesterday's State of the Tribes address given by Chairman Robert Van Zyl Jr. Mentioned a number of issues, and we'll get right back to him with Judge Ackley as soon as we can connect to him. As long as I've got the opportunity here, let me run down tomorrow morning right here on the Ideas Network for you. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, Kate Archer Kent will be examining a recent Harvard Kennedy School study on the decline of local news, the impact on civic life, and what we here at public radio might be able to do to fill the void. Also tomorrow, silver medalist Kenny Bednarik from Rice Lake joins the morning show. He's an Olympic silver medalist. Take a look at the life, a day in the life of a professional track and field athlete. And also tomorrow morning from 7 to 9, UW lacrosse historian looks at the people we choose to literally put on our pedestals and why they are so few honoring women. That's tomorrow on the morning show from 7 to 9 right here on the Ideas Network. Do we have Judge Ackley back yet? We do not. Gives me an opportunity to tell you what's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. And we have coming up tomorrow, the House of Representatives Weaponization of Government Subcommittee. Perhaps you've heard a little something about this so far. They've made some stunning claims about what they think is happening in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, we look at the evidence and what evidence have the hearings have produced so far, and what history tells us about how this investigation is likely to proceed and ultimately end. Also, tomorrow afternoon on Central Time, we're making a list, and we're going to solicit your support for the very best bad movies, your favorite trashy movies. They can't all be Oscar contenders. They're not all best movies. Sometimes a really good bad flick can make a perfect movie night. And I know you've got one in mind. So tomorrow, with your help and our guests, we're asking you to help make our list with our help. Let me see if we've got Judge Ackley joining us. Is he here? Yes. Judge Ackley, welcome back.
Yeah, there were some technical difficulties. I don't know if it's on my phone or your system, but that would be sort of my summary comments.
I appreciate that. Now to some of the specifics with the time we have remaining. One of the big issues yesterday was health care. Chairman Robert Van Zyl Jr. talked about how we can support Native communities when it comes to health care. How so, Judge Ackley?
Well, there were three statements in that. One is the nurse practitioners, due to profit and nonprofit hospitals, to me, the regulatory systems of the state perhaps could address that. And the other aspect is Marquette University, or the medical college, or the University of Wisconsin has their medical school. I know at St. Norbert's, where I live in Green Bay, they have a medical school. There ought to be some way that a nurse practitioner can be part of the team. So to me, that's a regulatory issue. Two, the Medicare, which receiving federal funds in the state and the tribe, they ought to find a way to work on that, not segment that. And the third one is mental health, opioid, other issues. That brings awareness from all parties, law enforcement, counselors, and other types. So to me, those need to be responsive issues by the state elected officials and their staff.
Judge Ackley, what do we know about how the opioid epidemic has hit our Native communities in Wisconsin?
Well, it's like many communities. There, you know, we live side by side, but the multi-jurisdictional task forces are working together. But as Van Zyl said, no matter what race, color, creed you are, they want to make sure that they stop the flow. So it's not necessarily northern tribes. I live in Green Bay, where there's a large tribal community, other places. So to me, it's a statewide issue and a national issue. So you have to address it in the models that are presented in coordination and cooperation to eradicate either to healthcare, law enforcement and other factors. So that's just an ongoing issue, and tribal communities are part within the state of Wisconsin. So that's another cooperative venture that could be explored.
Chairman Van Zyl referred to a black cloud hanging over Indigenous Wisconsinites yesterday in a State of the Tribes address, and he was talking about team mascots. What can we do about our team mascots, Judge Ackley?
Well, in 2005, when John Guard, the Republican Assembly, and then Act 31, is things have rapidly improved with the current Secretary of Interior. I'm not reflecting either Democrat or Republican, but the current Secretary of Interior has eliminated some of the names that are offensive within their federal systems for, you know, the National Park or Shawangunk National Forest or whatever those areas. And to me, education, whether it be Act 39, tribal people have to be, and non-tribal people have to be respectful of language. And since I didn't realize from 2005 to 2023, the Washington Commanders, and I remember back when this took place, the Marquette has changed. So has to happen, and it's out of respect for all parties.
Judge Ackley, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, and I do apologize about the technical difficulties, and there is so much more for us to talk about with the State of the Tribes address yesterday that took place at the state capitol. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk with a reporter who spent a full school year shadowing a trio of teachers. She shares their stories in her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up, the federal government seized two banks that collapsed over the weekend, and we'll check in on the Biden administration's response and what it means for your money. But first, the New York Times reported earlier this week on a 2022 survey from the National Education Association. It found that 55% of educators surveyed say they were considering leaving the profession altogether. That's more than half. Why is it more than half? Is it the pandemic? Is it the politics, the parents, the pay? And what do teachers have to say about all this? I'm asking. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you are a teacher, what's it like in your classroom today? Or if you're a parent, what do you see from your teachers? If you are a student, you can join us too at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can always email us as well. ideas@wpr.org. Our guest has spent a lot of time hearing from teachers about all of these things. Alexandra Robbins is an author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. Those books include The Overachievers, The Secret Lives of Driven Kids. Her new book came out just yesterday. It's The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Alexandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with that National Education Association survey from last year. It found that 55% of educators were considering leaving their profession. What's your reaction to that?
That number might actually be low.
The
morale among teachers is extremely low right now. And it's not just because of the pandemic. The issues in the education system started before the pandemic. It's just the pandemic exacerbated them, and the treatment of teachers has gotten worse.
So it's not just the pandemic then. So what were these issues before the pandemic that teachers were seeing that were driving them to consider leaving the job?
Sure. Well, teachers are incredibly hardworking professionals who work an alarming number of hours unpaid, but instead of our gratitude and a proper salary, they're getting disparaged and demoralized. Right now, the teacher pay gap has hit a record high. U.S. teachers earn 24% less than professionals with similar education and experience. That's demoralizing. Then you have a job where district officials and sometimes principals pile on extra responsibilities onto teachers without giving them the resources, support staff, or planning time to do that within their paid contractual hours. So teachers are working late into the night, almost every night, trying to get their job done.
And yet at the same time, as you write in your new book, the teachers, they often have to take on secondary jobs just to pay the bills.
That's right. So I followed three teachers for a year to make it sort of an interesting behind the scenes story with characters who whom readers would work for. One of those teachers, Penny, she was an 18-year teaching veteran, an award-winning teacher, and she was making $47,000 a year. And she couldn't live on that. She had two extra jobs.
And there are two others that we'll get to, but we should also mention, Alexandra, that you were a substitute teacher as well. How did that experience suit you?
So it's interesting. I see what teachers mean by they love teaching, but they do not love being a teacher. The act of teaching is beautiful, just connecting with students and colleagues and having this mutual learning and growing experience and impacting their lives and seeing them make connections. There's just joy and exhilaration in that. You know, I grew up playing sports and I've experienced runner's high during sports, but teacher's high is way better. However, I subbed almost the whole year. I subbed more than 150 days out of 180. And for the whole year, including almost a semester spent as a full-time third grade teacher, I made $17,000. So I understand what teachers are going through.
Wow. And you write about this in your book. And here's a quote I've got highlighted. Making joy happen is a driving force unlike any other I have ever experienced. So when we talk about why teachers stay, this has to be at least one of the big underlying reasons, Alexandra.
They stay for the students. Absolutely. They leave because the adults. It's true. They leave because of administrators. They leave because of district officials. They leave because of parents. Who? You want to talk about parents? That's a whole other show.
So introduce us to the three teachers that you shadowed for a whole school year. And I think you mentioned Penny, who was an 18-year teacher who was making less than $50,000 as a sixth grade math teacher.
Yes, she was a math teacher in the South. I followed Miguel, a Western special ed teacher who was fighting to save both his school and the special ed program that his school board was trying to destroy. And Rebecca, an East Coast elementary school teacher. Now, Rebecca, she hadn't had a date in 5 years because her work was all consuming. And her boyfriend had even broken up with her because he said she was spending so much time at home working on teaching rather than paying attention to him. So I followed her the year she tried to get back into the dating pool to see if she could teach and have a work-life balance at the same time.
Yeah, and she couldn't.
I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. It's a story that we follow, and you know, the ups and the downs and the maybes.
And I got it. You start the book with the start of a new school year, and I got that feeling of the anxiety, but the excitement of the start of a new school year. And as you detail, it's not just the students that feel that way, it's the teachers as well. They get excited for this school year, and then you go through the school year in your book month by month, and it's just, it sounds like such a challenge to just get back to that making joy that is such a cause or reason for teachers to do what they do.
And you know what one of the hardest months of the year is? Right now, March. Some teachers call it Death March because it's like this long slog with no break or holidays.
Yeah, that sounds about right. How big of an issue do you see perception versus reality being here? The work of teachers and public opinion or even portrayal in the news media compared to what you saw and what you experienced in your work for this new book?
The public has no idea what teachers really go through. That was the point of the book. I want the public to be aware of educators' unacceptable working conditions. This wouldn't be tolerated in any other job. We dump so much stuff on teachers. But yet I also wanted the public to see the joys that teachers feel and just how much teachers go above and beyond for, they call them their kids. They don't call them their students. I interviewed hundreds of teachers across the country, and they all said, my kids. And that's how they really feel.
Alexandra Robbins, our guest. She is the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Just this week, the New York Times listed it as one of 19 works of nonfiction to read this spring. And here's another quote from the book that stuck with me that you were speaking about, Alexandra. Teachers are the country's silent, constant superheroes, and that's a big problem. They shouldn't be our superheroes, you write. Why?
Because what has happened is that teachers have become, as I said, the dumping ground. It's like all of society's failures, all of the government's failures rest on teachers' shoulders. And I'll give you a sort of a somber example of that. The only thing that changed between the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre and the 2022 Robb Elementary School massacre was that teachers were trained to hide their students and barricade the door. Nothing else really changed substantively in society. So this is an example of teachers having to bear the weight and responsibility for society's failures. We saw in the pandemic that public schools were having to feed children because the government wasn't taking care of them. Again, we had to go to teachers and school staff to feed food insecure students. It's like everything comes down to teachers, and they're not being paid for it.
Going above and beyond on a regular basis. So you also talk about, and I think this is towards the end of your book, Alexandra, about the catch-22 that the education system itself finds itself in with, you know, a void for teachers, the need for teachers, an education system that would need to change in order to get more teachers. So what comes first? How does the education system change to accommodate a teacher being able to afford to live and do what they love?
Yeah, the job has to change. First, higher pay for teachers. And I don't mean that glibly. Studies actually show that students' math and English scores are significantly higher in districts that have higher base salaries for teachers. We also need more support staff, more counselors, aides, paraeducators, and a full-time nurse in every school. And most of all, we need a job that can actually be managed during teachers' paid contracted hours at school rather than bleed late into the night unpaid.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with author of 5 best-selling New York Times books, Alexandra Robbins, about her new book, which came out yesterday. It's called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. It follows 3 teachers throughout the school year, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest, and what's resonating with you here? What strikes a chord? Whether you are a teacher, a student, a parent, administrator, the custodial staff, it all goes into making it happen every day in the classroom. How are the connections with the teachers and the parents? What do you see from where you sit today about education in America right now? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with the author and reporter Alexandra Robbins. Her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. And we want to hear what you think about your teachers today, past, present, 1-800-642-1234. And if you're an educator in the classroom, share what you see. 1-800-642-1234. Have you considered looking for another job elsewhere? What is it that keeps you with these kids? You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, or share your observations on our Facebook Ideas Network Facebook page. And what about the politics of teaching today, Alexandra? Where are the perils in that?
Well, we live in a very strange time. We live in a time where certain politicians are pushing to censor teaching and classroom discussions of race, racism, gender, and LGBTQ issues. They're galvanizing parents by packaging these measures as parents' rights. However, this does not include all parents. Their messages of exclusion and bigotry pander to only a certain small subset of parents. And what this has done in the education landscape is there's been sort of a targeting of teachers who are sort of caught in the middle of the things that they know actually happened in U.S. history, or the things they know they need to teach, or the things that students need to confide in trusted adults like teachers and guidance counselors, and the politicians who are saying, well, no, you can't. And I'll give you examples. A New Hampshire parent group offered a bounty for anyone who caught a teacher talking about racism or sexism in schools, I think $500. A Pennsylvania elected official, a state representative, told right-wing parents to become substitute teachers just so they can spy on other teachers. This is a pretty intense anti-teacher sentiment that not only makes this one of the most difficult times to be a teacher, but also is part of this large national movement attacking public schools.
Yeah, Christina on our Facebook page wrote a challenge they see teachers facing is censorship by the political right. But it's being the way it's we read about it is parents' bill of rights. The parents have a set of rights when it comes to their child's education. How do you balance those in the classroom?
Well, you know, I think parents have the right. I'll give you an example. Let's talk about the books. Yeah. Parents have the right to monitor what their own child reads if that's how they want to parent. But they do not have the right to control what all children read. So parents, instead of just saying to their child, you know what, I don't want you to read a book about XYZ, they're saying ban the book entirely, take them out of the library. And worse, now they're talking about pressing charges against school librarians or teachers who have those books in their classrooms and make them accessible to students.
I'm glad you mentioned school librarians, because this is a part of your new book, The Teachers. Alexandra, talking about the role that school librarians play and specialist teachers play as well, and how those often seem to be the first things to be cut when it comes time for budgeting for education.
Librarians are extremely underestimated. Students are actually more likely to graduate, master academic standards, and score higher on tests if their school has a full-time qualified librarian. However, 40% of K through 12 schools don't have a full-time librarian, and nearly a third of school districts in our country don't have any librarians at all. We need them. They're central to student success.
Mm. Alexandra Robbins, our guest, the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. You're welcome to join the conversation. Tell us what you see from where you are today at 1-800-642-1234. And the book details the lives, 1 year in the life of three teachers. And one of those teachers is Miguel, who you mentioned before, a middle school special education teacher. But I also become invested in some of these students that these teachers have in their classroom every way. And one of those that stuck out to me was the relationship Miguel had with Eli in his classroom through the school year. Can you share a little of that with us, Alexandra?
Yeah, Eli had a bad reputation in school. Prior educators had said, well, he comes to school late or he doesn't come at all. And then every year, regularly, he would bolt from the classroom for no reason. And so Miguel started the year saying, he told me, he said, I'm going to treat Eli like the student I want him to be rather than the student that I heard that he was. And he did. He just exuded such a warmth when Eli came to the classroom. When Eli came in, 2 hours late, Miguel wouldn't say anything about being late. He'd say, hey, Eli, I'm so glad you're here. It turned out Eli was homeless. So Eli was dealing with so many more challenges than meets the eye. And Miguel's hard work with him was a really inspiring story to follow.
Yeah, these classrooms don't happen in a vacuum. And you detail this in no uncertain terms in your book, The Teachers, that it's part of the context that are part of the lives of the teachers and the students. But that classroom is so, indelible. I can still remember all the names of my grade school teachers, and they've all become a part of who I am today. So they don't happen in a vacuum. But do we recognize that as the role that these schools play in the lives that these kids have?
People aren't thinking about that. They're not thinking about the teachers. And there are so many teachers who told me they do this when their kids are at recess. The teachers buy food And when the kids are at recess, they stuff backpacks of food insecure children with the food so that they know that at least their family will have something to eat. Teachers are doing this, paying out of their own pocket. 94% of teachers pay for their own classroom supplies out of pocket, an average of $500 a year. Penny once spent $2,000 in a year. And part of that is looking out for kids who can't afford things.
Penny is one of the three teachers you detail in your new book, The Teachers: A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I have to ask you, out of curiosity, after reading the book, did you find the three best teachers in America? Or are these just indicative of what you find in any classroom, in any school, everywhere?
Any classroom, any school, anywhere. I there are so many teachers I could have followed. I interviewed hundreds. So many would have had great stories. I chose Rebecca, Penny, and Miguel because I knew that readers would both relate to their stories and find them captivating.
Let's go to your questions and comments now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Alexandra Robbins. Camille in New Berlin, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Am I, can you hear me correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yes, putting more money into the schools. First of all, I was a teacher for over 30 years. I served 5 years on our local school board. If putting more money into the school means that superintendents can create new positions like assistant superintendents, more directors of curriculum, these are two-year contracts. The people earn 2 to 3 times what a teacher does, the average teacher does. And then you can't even get rid of them because if there's budget crunches, because they're on 2-year contracts. So unless we get a grasp on where the money is being spent and put it back into people who directly impact the lives of kids, we're not going to see much of a change.
Camille, thank you for your call and your observation. Alexandra, what do you see there?
Oh, I agree with that 100%. It's called central office bloat. People say, oh, well, we don't have any more money for the schools. Yes, we do. It's just that superintendents and district officials are putting the money into more district official positions, extra chiefs of staff, extra, you know, assistant director of something or other. And Camille's exactly right. And they don't have anything to do with the students. They don't have anything to do directly in schools. And they make 6-figure salaries. It's ridiculous. Yeah, we have the money. It just shouldn't be going to the central office. It should be going to the teachers.
And as you detail in the teachers, it's when Miguel gets an aide in his classroom that seems to turn the entire school year around, even the students.
Yeah, Miguel was getting assaulted in his classroom on a daily basis. He was bitten, he was punched, he was hit. This was the year before I followed him. That happened. And he kept complaining to the district saying, you keep sending me these moderately to severely disabled students, but you're not sending me any assistance. And I can't do this all by myself. And they kept saying, no, you're fine. No, you're fine. Then the district official in charge of assistance came to the school and he showed her the bite marks up and down his arm. And she shrugged and she said, well, that's just part of the job. Well, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It should not be part of the job.
Where else would that be part of the job except for maybe
exactly.
Mixed martial arts? I don't know outside of that, but there's no biting in mixed martial arts.
I hope not.
So one of the things you challenge in your book, Alexandra, is teacher burnout. And you provide a bigger perspective and say in some context, teacher burnout's a myth. Explain that.
Teacher burnout is a myth because, okay, so the phrase teacher burnout is a way of talking about exhaustion from overwork. It's misleading because experts say that the burnout for teachers is caused by inadequate workplace support and resources, high stakes testing, stuff like that. But instead of fixing these issues like any normal workplace would do, districts often say, well, the teacher should just do a better job of, and I'm air quoting here, self-care, as if it's on them to relieve the stress caused by a job that's impossible to do. So I say teacher burnout is a myth. The feelings that teachers have are extremely valid and they're going through this. However, it's not their fault. Instead of saying things like, oh, well, teachers have the highest burnout levels, we should be saying, no, school systems are the employers worst at providing employees with necessary supports and resources.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your new book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Robbins is an author of 5 New York Times bestselling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. We were talking to her today about her book just out yesterday. It's called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Now, coming up after the news, an economist joins us to look at the state of banking in the U.S. after the federal government seized 2 financial institutions in the 2nd and 3rd largest bank collapses in U.S. history over the weekend. What's next? Stay tuned. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network.